Good evening. Before beginning to lay out what one might possibly mean by a steady state aesthetics, I just had the experience of being out in Colorado and someone said, what is this talk you're giving about? I said steady state aesthetics, which was, caused blank stares in everyone, even in New York, probably certainly in the middle of the country. Before doing that, I want to simply do something simpler. Thank you all for coming this evening, and in particular to thank Jan Jasky, the director of the Artists Institute, for having invited me, and the Institute's gallery manager, Chris Aki, I hope that's more or less how to say it, for having invited me to talk tonight on whatever it is that I mean by steady state aesthetics. Thanks are due to them, especially because I'm not an artist in the usual acceptation of the term in the context of a place like this, where artist typically refers to a visual artist. I'm not a painter or sculptor or photographer or video artist, but a writer of both essays and fiction and so far one play. And I take the fact of my having been invited to speak to what is at least in large part an art world audience on behalf of something called the Artists Institute as a reflection of Jenny's generosity. It's a generous gesture to include me in the category of artist. But not only this, here I am, a writer you're encouraged to think of as an artist, much as another of the fellows this season, the sculptor Nina Cannell, is an artist, and just as Jenny's programming also encourages you to think of the percussionist and healer Milford Graves as an artist, though for the most part, he's not a visual artist either. And this small local breakdown of the boundary between visual art and other things that are not different kinds of art or activity, like writing or healing, not usually put in the same categories, painting or sculpture or performance art, etc. This breakdown seems to me symptomatic of a larger identity crisis in the art world. We can think of recent instances of people simply setting up a shop somewhere in the middle of the country and calling it art, or an artist simply framing and posting financial documents on a museum wall, without any effort to excite the visual imagination. In a complementary way, we can think of the sensation of pleasant nostalgia it's easy to feel in the Whitney Museum's having accorded a mid-career retrospective to the painter Laura Owens, thereby showing, as the Whitney's director has said, that painting can still be interesting. In other words, it's become natural to accord lots of stuff that isn't visual art the status of art, and also natural to sound a little defensive in proposing that a painter is a big deal visual artist. Both of which things simply testify to a particularly acute uncertainty at the moment about what it is that art is and can and should do. To a degree, this very uncertainty is constitutive of the art of recent centuries, which is not meant, as we take art in prior times and earlier cultures to have been meant, straightforwardly to confirm the values and celebrate the practices and glorify the origins of a given people, whichever people they might be, or to ratify the community's traditional metaphysical or theological orientation, with perhaps a few revisions, or even to celebrate the physical persons and possessions of the aristocracy and upper bourgeoisie, as much portrait painting did in earlier modern times, and much still does, but not generally painting that we regard as high art. What is the point of art? Art as we know it, the art, in other words, of modern and general and capitalist times. The kind of art that includes modern art since the latter 19th century, and also contemporary art. It's easy to recur to Kant's famous definition of art as being characterized by the purposiveness without purpose. So it's not as if it's a new thing that we don't know exactly what art is or is for. Even so, the crisis of art's purpose and identity, we don't know exactly what art is, or what it's supposed to do, where exactly its boundaries lies, seems different these days. Not merely the existential freedom and risk that's characterized modern and contemporary art from the beginning, but a new sensation of being at sea in midair, as it were. At its best, not having a clear purpose or meaning is a feeling of being free. And the story of contemporary and modern art could certainly be told triumphantly and not inaccurately as a continual conquest of freedom, an ever greater enlargement of the things that artists can do, both socially, what they can get away with doing, and technically, what they're physically capable of doing. But the opposite side of the coin to this feeling of unbounded freedom and uncircumscribed mission is a feeling or anxiety about not knowing what you're doing, or why, or for whom. And I take it that's one reason I've been invited to talk tonight. I, who am not an artist or an art critic or an art theorist, I think to a historically unusual degree, the artist's exhilarating sensation of liberty, I can do whatever I want, something that's never been done before, has become an anxious fear of acting and producing without knowing why, of means divorced from ends. In other words, of something opposite to freedom and liberty, namely empty compulsion. And in talking about the connection of art to economic growth, I want to suggest something about why this might be so. And also in proposing the notion of steady state aesthetics, I want to at least try to glimpse a different condition for art, different in large part because the production of art in modern or contemporary societies would no longer be fundamentally connected to economic growth. Because economic growth would have ceased, meaning we are no longer living under conditions of continuous compound economic growth and capital accumulation, which the classical political economist John Stuart Mill called the progressive state, but had instead entered what Mill called the stationary state, where growth was over, a condition that ecological economists in recent decades have called the steady state or a steady state economy. In other words, the title of my talk, Steady State Aesthetics, is a bit of a misnomer because I want to talk about the opposite phenomenon first, namely the aesthetics of continual compound economic growth, which I'll want to argue have been to a great degree the invisible and default aesthetics of recent centuries in capitalist or otherwise modern countries, and particularly so over the past few decades. My approach to the concept of steady state aesthetics then is a sort of via negativa, where the object under consideration, this new sort of possible future orientation towards art that I'm calling steady state aesthetics, is defined negatively by describing an orientation that instead is caught up in the compulsion towards economic growth. To imagine or envisage the art of the steady state, we have to first try to understand what the art of growthism, as some historians of economic growth have called it, has been. I'm enough of a historical materialist to believe that the art of a given society is going to be fundamentally defined by its mode of production. And in a way, what I want to do is simply to consider the relationship between what Marxists call expanded reproduction, what the newspapers and everyday politicians praise as economic growth, and our way of making and receiving artworks. But in engaging in this classically Marxist or historical materialist operation of trying to tie art to the economy, I'm not such an Adornian to think of Theodore Adorno, possibly the greatest Marxist thinker about art from the last century, I'm not such an Adornian as to insist, as Adorno did, that it's a sort of offense against any kind of utopia to describe it or imagine it at all. Adorno extended the ban on graven images to all images of a different and better kind of society, and I'm going to offer, if not a graven image, of a steady state economy, on top of which, in some future time, you could imagine a steady state variety of art making and aesthetics arising, then at least a little sketch of what such a thing might be. As I say, I'm not an artist and certainly have no training as an art historian, but I've written several long essays on art theory. So what I want to do in discussing the relationship between art and economic growth is to make use of my naivete and to invite you to become naive for a moment too and allow yourself to be struck by the features of our world, including our art world, that only a neophyte could easily perceive. Since if we are historical materialists in our thoughts about art, we need to start with the economy. Let's start with the extraordinarily rare and strange phenomenon and fact of economic growth. GDP, or gross domestic product, is a concept that only dates from the 1930s. And standardized statistics on economic growth, measured in how many percentage points this year's GDP is larger than last year's for a given country, only emerged after the Second World War, which means that our statistics for pre-modern economies are highly approximate. But economists have estimated that before the 19th century, the rate of economic growth in different societies only rarely exceeded the rate of population growth, and then not for very long. Growth was simply negligible. Whereas since the Industrial Revolution, capitalist and, while they existed, communist economies have been capable of growing at around 2% a year, and often much faster, leading economies to double in size every generation or two, something never before experienced in human history. This is something that a naive alien observer of our societies would, I think, find striking. And what would the naive anthropologist from another planet say about modern and contemporary art? He or she might observe what to us is so obvious that it seems beneath any notice. Namely, that modern and contemporary art is a phenomenon of recent centuries, and that while correlation is not causation, it seems roughly coeval with sustained economic growth, this previously unheard of condition. What distinguishes modern from other kinds of prior kinds of art? At a minimum, there appears to be a different relationship to tradition. Pre-modern art might seek to modify traditional and communal views of the world, and Max Weber and Werner Sombart both distinguish between traditional and non-traditional periods in pre-modern societies. Sometimes, for example, theology would undergo little revision from generation to generation, and sometimes the revisions would be rapid and fundamental. But even in non-traditional periods of culture and therefore of art, even these periods were, by our standards, marked by a sustained and explicit continuity with the metaphysical and artistic inheritance of the past, something which I don't think we need to be nostalgic about, but we can simply recognize in the key, such art and culture, of modification rather than rupture. By contrast, with modernity, the suddenly new rather than the faithfully continuous becomes the signature of art. Economic growth clearly belongs among the fundamental features of modernity, and without it, the compulsion to novelty, characteristic of much art since the Industrial Revolution, is difficult to imagine. But so far, this just looks like a homology. The economy constantly revolutionizes itself, and so does art. Is there actually a causal relationship? Adorno at least thought that there was, as I discovered going back over his aesthetic theory, where I may have initially picked up some of these ideas that later on this past summer I thought of as my own discovery in conversations with Jenny. Nouveauté, or novelty, Adorno writes, is aesthetically the result of historical development, the trademark of consumer goods appropriated by art, by means of which artworks distinguish themselves from the ever same inventory in obedience to the need for the exploitation of capital, which, if it does not expand, if it does not, in its own language, offer something new, is eclipsed. The new is the aesthetic seal of expanded reproduction, with its promise of undiminished plenitude. Baudelaire's poetry, he says, was the first to codify this. The mention of Baudelaire's poetry places the origins of this compulsion for the new around 1857, when Les Fleurs du Mal was first published, which is close to the date conventionally given for the beginnings of what we call modern art with respect to the visual arts. Now, a lot has happened between 1857 and 2017, and I'll try and distinguish some periods within this longer span in a moment, periods which register transformations in our experience of the new. But I want first just to observe that although the idea of a cult of the new, or as it's been called, a tradition of the new, may itself seem old hat these days, confirming Adorno's warning that the abstractly new can stagnate and fall back into the ever same, the rather blank exaltation of the new for its own sake persists very much down to our own day. It's a kind of zombie novelty, you might say. Let me cite a few lines from a piece by the art critic Jed Pearl in a very recent number of the New York Review of Books, just a few weeks ago, about Donald Judd. Not because it seems to me especially zombified, but only because it's so typical. Pearl praises Judd as a man who is never afraid to say no. Judd's no is that of the dedicated avant-gardist, the man who leads the charge. This no is fundamentally positive and celebratory, a cry for the new. Judd believed that the search for the new involved a rejection of the conventions of painting and sculpture in favor of new forms. I think whenever we find this kind of tautological praise, Judd believed the new involved rejecting conventions in favor of the new, we can confidently suppose we've run up against real ideology. Why is the new so great? Why is the great necessarily new? Well, it goes without saying. Adorno had one idea for why the rationale for celebrating the new would go without saying. And his idea was that this rationale had to go without saying because it was essentially taboo and couldn't be said out loud. For Adorno, in the passage I quoted above, art as a type of commodity is merely mimicking the imperative of novelty and expansion and improvement and branding, we might add, the iPhone 10 rather than the iPhone 6, disruption as the goal for any new startup, that characterizes the marketing of other commodities under expanded capital reproduction, or, as we call it, growth. Novelty makes you stand out from other kinds of commodities for sale, and this goes for art commodities as well as for other kinds of commodities. The reason art can't confess to the state of affairs is that it is meant to evoke a realm of final utility or pleasure rather than intermediate exchange, which, in spite of everything, it does in fact do. And therefore, art can't openly confess, nor can art connoisseurs openly admit, the commodity character of modern art. I think we can accept Adorno's argument as far as it goes without considering it exhaustive. Part of the novelty compulsion of modern art is to be explained by its commodity character, yes. But another part, I think, must have to do with economic growth and growthism. Capitalist societies are societies that, from an economic point of view, progress without any goal. As Wallerstein says, endless capital accumulation doesn't only mean the process has no end in sight, that we can, has no end in sight, but that it has no end in the sense of having no goal, no point. It seems to me this must affect art and art's novelty compulsion in at least two ways. First, endless capital accumulation and continuous economic growth occurring as they do for no explicit purpose mean that insofar as art is going to reflect social reality, it must reflect changing conditions, and in this sense, must commit itself to the reflection of the new. The French anthropologist Marc Auger gets at something like this when he says in his little book called The Future that Flaubert's characters are primarily expressions of an era. Flaubert here figured as sort of the great and typical realist. The nature of a growth society is that it's constantly changing, constantly begetting new eras in terms of social mores and material culture. And even the most formally conservative art can, for this reason, secure its claim to novelty merely by accurately reflecting new and changing conditions. That is to say, a heroine with purple hair, something in Lady Bird. And for this reason, formally conservative kinds of art that are reflective of social change, like, say, realist novels, feature films, and documentary photography, have been less beset by the crisis of meaning than types of art, say painting or classical music or jazz or poetry, that don't naturally or automatically reflect society in the same way. The point of which is simply to say the novelty compulsion in art bespeaks not only the artwork's commodity character, as Adorno said, but more admirably its documentary character as some kind of troubled mirror of continuously changing social circumstances. And there's a second reason the novelty compulsion is bound up with growthism that goes beyond the commodity nature of art. We have a lot of reflection, much of it indispensable, about art as a capitalist commodity. But most people don't have any direct experience of capital accumulation. Most people are not, after all, capitalists. What they do experience is headlong social change of the kind produced by continuous economic growth. And the newness of new art seems, among other things, a way to experience the shock of the new homeopathically, as it were. That is, through an artwork, you get to absorb in small doses the onrushing, unmeaning nature of rapid social change that otherwise comes at you in unmanageably large doses. A formally smoothed over and digested dose of novelty administered by art inoculates you to a degree against the flood tide of social and historical novelty that otherwise threatens to drown you. I expect that this that I've just said was true in the 19th century and is still true today. But it seems to me too that the relationship of growth in the economy to novelty, or as Adorno has it, nouveauté in art, has also changed over the past century and a half. Let's distinguish economic growth from growthism. Economic growth means increased capacity to do and have things, and growthism means the belief that this is good. For a long time, until as late as the 1960s or even in the 1990s, it seems to me that growth growthism were connected to an idea of progress. For liberals, this might mean the advance of reason and the decline of intellectual and social prejudice. For socialists, social modernity and also modernism in the arts were bound up with an expectation of at least the possibility of social revolution. Here on the centenary of the October Revolution in Russia, we can recall these hopes. This bred a feeling that in one's relationship to modernity and to modern art, one was taking sides and had to be, an attitude that seems to me different from the one that we find natural today. One or two kinds of art were emphatically the right kind to be doing, and others were not. That, to oversimplify, was the attitude of art connoisseurs, whereas today, as we'll come to, an easygoing eclecticism tends to prevail. Art comes in all sorts of forms, and it's all good. Even before the advent and near universalization of the kind of eclecticism or growth liberalism, I'll get around to calling it, that we'll discuss in a minute, even before this, I think the tradition of the new was haunted by the feeling that despite its devotion to the new, and as Hannah Arendt would say, to natality, that is to the newly born, the novelty compulsion of growthism was basically sterile rather than fertile. Economic growth is defined formalistically, largely in terms of the expansion of productive capacity, mere capacity, not what you use the new capacity for. In other words, it doesn't express a belief in what to do with life, either for an individual or a society. It expresses a belief that your capacities should be as great as possible. And to the question of then what, it simply replies, develop even more capacity. In his book on the future, the anthropologist I referred to before, Marc Auger, distinguishes between new occurrences that are inaugurations, essentially inaugurations of new traditions, and those which combine a beginning and an end in the same gesture. Many, perhaps most, celebrated heroic instances of modern art are in this sense less fertile inaugurations of the kind that would provoke new traditions or new genres, then there are essentially sterile singularities of the kind we recognize from Walter Benjamin's famous remark that all truly great modern works of art both found and dissolve a genre. We feel that a truly special style in modern or contemporary artist does away with both predecessors and successors, such that growth in the technical capacities available to art, the potential it's demonstrated, comes to seem an empty arsenal, accumulated not for the sake of any practical purpose, not as the foundation of any new tradition or the original utterance of any new chain of meaning, but as a singular end/beginning, a combined beginning and end. Capacity is acquired for no purpose. Development occurs, but without any connection to progress, whether of a liberal or radical kind. In this way, strikingly new art seems both to reflect and to reject the kind of growthism that values the enlargement of practical or social capacity without daring to suggest what on earth this capacity should be used for. In Adorno, this is referred to as the fetishization of means, that is, the artist's technique, to the neglect of any defined ends. There's an excellent work of history by Robert Collins called More, The Politics of Economic Growth in Postwar America. And in it, Collins describes the transition between the Eisenhower years and the new Kennedy administration of the early 1960s in terms of what he calls growth liberalism. I think it's worth recalling the famous speech of Dwight Eisenhower on the military-industrial complex, where Eisenhower says, "Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this, a modern brick school in more than 30 cities." Eisenhower, as a Republican, had his own reasons, which we don't have to share, for being skeptical of the benefits of continuous economic growth. In particular, he was afraid it would breed inflation, which would eat away at the value of accumulated capital. But his conservative awareness of trade-offs is in some ways like a conservationist or an ecologist view of the inevitable loss or entropy involved in any expenditure of energy. And money is really nothing other than stored social energy. Every gun we manufacture is so many pounds of butter we fail to put on somebody's table. In such circumstances, circumstances of scarcity, it's imperative to establish a basic hierarchy of values. Is expending limited resources or energy or money on welfare more important to you, or spending it on warfare? Now, Eisenhower's skepticism, or you might say conservatism, about growth was succeeded with the election of Kennedy and Johnson on the Democratic ticket in 1960 by what Collins calls growth liberalism. The fundamental tenet of growth liberalism is that given enough economic growth, you don't particularly need to decide among priorities. You can afford both to build Johnson's Great Society and to rain bombs across all of Indochina and send tens of thousands of troops to Vietnam. There is no necessary choice between full social democracy and military imperialism on a global scale. Art, of course, never directly either kills or feeds anyone, but I want to suggest an attitude analogous to growth liberalism comes easily to us in a growing capitalist economy in the face of the arts and especially the visual arts. Where there is a sense of constantly increasing capacity, artistic capacity, just like economic capacity, we experience much less need than otherwise to make choices between kinds of art or even different artists. We can experience them all as simply adding to capacity and contributing to the gross artistic product. And this is especially the case for the visual arts for a simple reason having to do with how paintings and sculptures, etc., are received. It takes a number of hours to read even a short novel, as you know. It takes a fixed amount of time to sit through a play or a movie or a concert or a record that you play or these days stream at home. This is not so with the visual arts. Even if there are single paintings I could look at closely every day with the reward of constantly appreciating, increasing appreciation, I can also take in the greatest and most complex visual masterpieces at a glance, a sort of aesthetics, not to mention simpler productions. And so the audience for the visual arts is especially prone to a sort of aesthetics analogous to growth liberalism, where fundamental choices don't need to be made. It's simply the more of everything, the better. It's like their website Contemporary Art Daily. You can see and appreciate everything. I've wanted to suggest that this attitude has been present in the art world for a long time, a sort of barren eclecticism, the tendency to accumulate means without any connection to ends, but also that mere growthism of this kind was moderated and masked for a century and more by either liberal or radical notions of progress. Liberals could feel, grossly put, that art was destroying ancient moral and social prejudice. And radicals could feel that art was set not just against bourgeois values, as the liberals believed, but also against bourgeois society in the sense of an economic order founded on capital. Belief in progress, in other words, implied capacity, whether artistic or economic, that expansion of the arsenal of available technique was not expansion for its own sake, after the model of the cancer cell, but expansion or growth in the service of an end. And it seems to me that just this is what we can no longer believe. Growth is no longer attached to progress, but is a process with no end other than itself. The ends, that is the works, are replaced by their possibilities. I was quoting Adorno last time to suggest we've entered a terrain he glimpsed in the late 1960s. Thus, he goes on, the works themselves become a matter of indifference. Not what they do, but what works could do. Art could, in theory, be saved from this indifference either by scarcity, which growthism destroys, or by contributing to the contested outcome of history. That was what the ideologies of progress implied. The contemporary abundance of art, and especially visual art, on the other hand, in a context where it's difficult to feel that any art interrupts the progress of expanded reproduction and capital accumulation, means that art, since the end of history, contributes to growth, but no longer to progress. The rhythm of growth was always the basso continuo of the dynamic of modern and contemporary art, I think. But today, as with the very worst kind of house music, one can find oneself hearing the driving bass line and nothing else. I'll say more about what steady state aesthetics might look like in just a minute, but for now, let it be enough to say that in a steady state, the taste equivalent of growth liberalism would be harder and perhaps impossible to sustain. The creation of any work of art would mean that another work of art is not created. And the same goes in diminished form for the appreciation of a given work of art. In this way, only the end of growth seems likely to rescue old ambitions of progress. This is particularly the case since today the goal of economic growth can only remind one of the ecological devastation that accompanies it and which we must arrest. So far, my very crude schema of growthism through progress and then growthism without progress may seem a bad enough case of vulgar Marxism. But I want, before broaching a vision of steady state aesthetics, to make it even worse, because I've so far failed to really consider artworks as commodities, that is, as elements of the art market. I've already suggested in the most basic terms that something happens to art after World War II, and especially after the 1990s. Growth for the sake of progress, whether liberal or radical, becomes growth for the hell of it, for no reason. In other words, becomes stained with the mad and finally suicidal compulsion of endless and thus pointless capital accumulation. But in saying all this, I've neglected to consider the art market. There was a type of modern and even contemporary art that was made in state socialist societies, which had a relationship to growth and progress not unlike modernist art in the West. But it naturally lacked the same relationship to the market. And for this reason, it seems to me that modern art produced under capitalist circumstances might usefully be conceived of as capitalist art. What is capitalist art? Pre-modern or traditional art, to offer a choice of very unsatisfactory terms, seems to us defined by its sacral purposes and communal orientation, while it's no news that the art of recent centuries eludes easy definition in its purposes. Most other man-made objects, on the other hand, have an identifiable purpose, easy to define. Everybody knows what a fork, a shirt, a car is for, even if ideally they also have aesthetic properties that supplement their narrowly utilitarian ones. Their purpose defines what they are. Modern and contemporary art, on the other hand, the essence of those things seems to lie in the very fact that the question about their purpose can even be asked. There is no such need to ask that question about virtually any other human manufacturers or even activities. It's curious, meanwhile, that while we have several all-purpose words for the activity of artists, who, whatever their medium, can all be said to make, produce, or create art, we have no all-purpose word for the receptive activity of the audience. Even audience sounds wrong, suggesting a group activity rather than an affair of individual experience not easily communicated to others. The consumers or receivers or observers or perceivers or spectators of art are, depending on the relevant context, instead known as readers or viewers or listeners or whatever. The reason it seems strange that we should have all-purpose or generic verbs for the activity of artists of all kinds, but not for the more passive activity of those who simply behold a work of art, is that making art is not, in fact, a generic activity for most individuals. An artist in one medium, a painter or a composer or a poet, will not usually work in other media, whereas most viewers of paintings are also listeners to music, readers of literature, and so on. The faculty to consume, as it were, all kinds of art is widespread. The faculty of producing all kinds of art is not. It seems strange, then, that we lack a general term for the highly general activity of experiencing art. But in conceiving of capitalist art and its reception, I don't mean to imply that all art produced in capitalist countries or for an international art market operating according to capitalist lines has been made by artists who are themselves capitalists in the practical or political terms. Most of them will have lacked the intention and or the ability to earn ever more money from their work. And many of them will have been political opponents of capital. Even those who didn't belong to or support left political parties will often have regretted the advent of capitalism, whether in reactionary, for example, fascist terms, or in merely nostalgic, for example, romantic ways, or will simply have failed to endorse or admire capitalism as a socioeconomic regime. Capitalist art would then not be defined by the presence or absence of capitalist intentions or pro-capitalist convictions on the part of artists, but simply by the capitalist circumstances under which it was produced by artists and received by an audience. It would not even be necessary for the art ever to have been bought or sold, traded as a commodity. Nevertheless, the relationship of artworks and the artist to the capitalist market seems very important. What kind of commodity is an artwork? The answer to that question, I mean to say, has changed over time. Economists distinguish capital goods from consumption goods. The purpose of capital goods, like machines in a factory, is to contribute to capital accumulation. The end of possession of the thing is to make money. The purpose of consumption goods is, on the other hand, simply to provide satisfaction to their purchasers while they last, whether like a sandwich, they don't last very long, or whether like a couch, they last a while longer. Capitalist art for a long time was, when it was sold as a commodity, something that tended to serve the purposes of consumption, both for the artist who produced it and for the buyer. We're leaving out the middleman, the dealer, who we can assume was interested in profit. The artist usually had little hope of getting rich, even if a few composers or authors, say Wagner or Dickens, did become rich, or whether performers like Liszt or Clara Schumann or Sarah Bernhardt could command large sums. Instead, the artist, from their point of view, and in spite of capitalist society, engaged, like most producers of other kinds of goods, in what Marx called simple commodity production and exchange. The producer, in this case, the producer of art, produced a commodity, that is, something saleable, with the mere aim of earning enough money that he could buy the commodities produced by others necessary to live at a certain standard of life, clothes, food, housing, etc. As for the collector who purchased the artwork, what was this commodity to him or to her? It may not sound quite right to refer to a painting as, say, a consumption good, in part because this sounds coldly utilitarian, and in part because artworks are typically meant to last. In other words, not to be rapidly consumed, but to endure for decades or even centuries. Still, at least prior to World War II, the particular commodity that a collector acquired in purchasing or commissioning a work tended to be, in essence, a consumption good, rather than a capital good, in that the art market was not usually for collectors of art, unlike art dealers, a speculative market where one could hope to invest in artworks as commodities that would appreciate over time. If the purchaser anticipated selling the work at all, rather than simply leaving it to an heir, it was not an expectation of getting a higher price than what had initially been paid. The consumption of the painting, consisting of its enjoyment by its possessor and perhaps their heirs, might take a long time, but consumption in the sense of the final use of an object for the sake of its use value, rather than exchange value, was its purpose, the commodity. That is, as with any consumption good, the point was use rather than exchange to satisfy some particular need or desire, not to acquire general or abstract exchange value in the form of money that can be exchanged for any use or purpose. And yet, as a consumption good, art stands apart from other consumption goods in that its use is not clear. In this way, a work of art could not only provide a specific, indeed, in the case of artworks that were not copied or reproduced, unique satisfactions proper to their distinctive characteristics, but an artwork participating in the fact of art in general, the phenomenon of art in general, served, in spite of its singular and unique nature, as a kind of abstract symbol of use value as such, the satisfaction of a particular need or desire in a particular place or time. This description of unique objects, for example, a painting, or existing objects that exist in limited editions, a series of prints, or one of several casts of a sculpture, involves art serving against expectation, perhaps, as consumption goods. It was, and largely still is today, different for other kinds of art, which more naturally were consumption goods, and for reasons intrinsic to the media, to their media. They tended to remain so. A musical recital, the staging of a play, or dance being ephemeral and consumed in the witnessing of it, because for a lecture, for obvious reasons, was at little risk of being a capital good or investment, and the same was true for different reasons of mass-produced, widely mass-produced and widely reproduced art that took the form of a printed book or print or later the recording of a performance. And yet this changed for the type of art, the type of fine art that we often are thinking of when we refer simply to art, these more singular, unique objects. Once art became, with the booming market, a capital good rather than a consumption good. The purpose was then largely to accumulate more value, even if the work provoked aesthetic satisfaction along the way. And for collectors, the art market became a robustly speculative one after World War II, and especially in recent decades. It seems more with every decade. In this sense, and putting things very crudely, art changed in its nature, capitalist art changed in its nature. If formerly it represented abstract use value, or purposiveness without a purpose, now it represented another form of exchange value. It became an intermediate rather than a final object. Now it represented, it now existed fundamentally in service to the one true final object, which is money, or abstract exchange value. So it is for art under growthism and financial speculation. A steady state economy, by contrast, would no longer grow. This means that even if the price of an individual work of art increased, the value of artworks in general couldn't do so without subtracting from the value of other sectors of the economy. On the whole, this would mean I could trade away an artwork for one I like better. Marx would call this simple commodity exchange. But it would mean that a collector could very rarely imagine making a profit in selling an artwork. I might improve, from my own standpoint, the use value of what hangs on my walls, but not so easily the exchange value. We've now outlined something of the situation of art, I hope, of fine art and the visual arts in particular, under a regime of continuous economic growth and endless capital accumulation. These circumstances are plainly hostile to the meaningfulness of art as some kind of improvisational metaphysics for post-traditional societies. From promising one or another kind of progress, all this just in summary, art comes to represent mere blank growth, a barren process today and an ecologically calamitous one tomorrow. From having served as radiant examples of abstract yet particular use value, as individually unique exemplars of the universal end of pleasure, artworks reduced to instances of growth and profit become mere further temporary embodiments of exchange value. All of this may sound like vulgar Marxism, and it is. Lenin, who achieved his revolution 100 years ago, famously said that one had to be as radical as reality. Today, we might say that the challenge is to be as vulgar as reality. But steady-state aesthetics is not, by contrast, a vulgar empirical thing that we can perceive, as the art of growthism is. It's a delicate, even gossamer possibility. No steady-state art world can properly come about before a growth-oriented capitalism bent on ecological ruin is replaced by a post-growth economy characterized by a sustainable biophysical throughput, as ecological economists would call it. What can we possibly know about the art of a kind of social formation that may very possibly never come to be in the first place? I have only a few suggestions to offer. We should think of the material culture that the revolutionary socialist William Morris describes in News from Nowhere, where skill and joy, all skill is joyful, Morris's disciple Yeats says somewhere, are embodied in the making of the objects that sustain the human world. We might also imagine a flattening of the hierarchy of labor, work, and action that Hannah Arendt describes in The Human Condition, where labor, which she taking over the values of a slave society, she disdains as merely reproducing the world whereas work creates new objects bearing the stamp of their individual creators. The feminist and ecological artist Miralee Lederman Ukeles, I don't know if I'm saying her name correctly, who had a wonderful retrospective at the Queen's Museum last year, was a visionary of what she called maintenance art, where the mere skillful sustaining of the world, repairing it and cleaning it, not creating it anew was recuperated for art. We don't need to worry, meanwhile, that a steady state economy sustaining a society we might characterize in terms of eco-socialism will be a boring place and lack for drama, as Adam Smith feared might be the case whenever economic growth and capitalist dynamism came to an end. If we read Kim Stanley Robinson's futuristic novel, The Wild Shore, about a sort of ecotopia in California, future California that comes under threat, we've done enough to understand that any sustainable and just society would experience the drama of constant threats to undermine it. Finally, I think steady state aesthetics would show a greater inclination to wisdom than to mere complaint and reflection. Where the economy no longer grows, one must do the best with what one has, the basic problem of wisdom and philosophy. I've already departed from art world convention by quoting Dwight Eisenhower at length, so let me now recite some words of John Maynard Keynes, who was not only a great economist, but a collector of art and a man who married a ballerina and, as his previous great love, had the painter Duncan Grant. Keynes, in his essay, Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, looked forward to a time when the economy would run more or less automatically and people might work for only 3 hours a day. The economic problem may be solved, he wrote in 1930, or be at least within sight of solution within 100 years. That's 13 years from now. This means that the economic problem, this is Keynes again, if we look into the future, is not the permanent problem of the human race. Thus, for the first time since his creation, man will be faced with his real, his permanent problem, how to use his freedom from economic cares, how to occupy the leisure which science and compound interest will have afforded him, to live wisely and agreeably and well. Classical Marxism imagined capitalism as the building up by private capitalists of general technical capacities that could one day be put to general, universal, and social ends. What if we were to think of art in the same way? For a century and a half and more, art discovered what it could do, but it seems with less and less idea as it went on of why or what for. There's nothing so embarrassing as to put forward one's ideas about what to live for and how or why. This must be especially so for artists who, as everyone knows, are the coolest people around and therefore at least risk of embarrassment. A steady state aesthetics might be one according to which artists risk the embarrassment of straining after the wisdom of ends along with the expertise of means. Philosophically, no doubt, it would be very clumsy. But possessed of sufficiently eloquent means to register in traces of impressive beauty, the new fumbling of people in a world that precisely because it had ceased to grow could now venture to learn how it might develop and change. That's it. I'm afraid we probably have time for some questions.
I have a question.
Sure.
Where do you think that, are there locations that you think steady state aesthetics applies? Because it seems like a really North American Eurocentric idea to me.
I don't know why that would be. I mean, I think that certainly growth is not a sort of Eurocentric phenomenon right now. We see much more rapid growth in the non-European, non-North American world, and certainly there's much more developmentalism characterizing a country like India or Turkey or China than is characterizing France or the United States. So I do think this idea, though, I think it's sort of only Eurocentric to the degree that it's capitalocentric, and capitalocentric used to be Eurocentric and has largely ceased to be. So I think that the so-called underdeveloped world as a place that capitalism penetrated less completely less soon, reflects types of art making that aren't so thoroughly caught up in growth and growthism. So I do think that we can probably look in a certain way to what probably inadequately we might call like more traditional art, but also but only to a degree, and only to a degree in two ways, both in the sense that a lot of what looks like tradition, like say like you know, the kind of like culture of like say Pachamama in South America, is largely like a kind of reconstituted thing created against capitalist modernity, not rather than something that just existed prior to capitalist modernity. And this is the same is true, I think, of Islamism or something. That is to say, these are types of tradition that are in fact newer than the kind of capitalist modernity to which they seem an antecedent. So I guess in that sense, however, I think like probably what looked to us like sort of traditional cultures may give us an idea of a way out, in the sense that they're I think more dynamic than we've given them credit for, more modern than we've given them credit for, and they're you know, ways I think of expressing how one could sort of be modern without growth. I mean, that's to say that I think I probably should have put this more clearly in this talk, but it seems to me that very crudely, if we kind of imagine there were once like slower societies, you know, more traditional societies, and then there's capitalism, sometimes communist modernity, what we have to imagine in the future is a type of modernity in the sense that it doesn't take things for granted in the same way that pre-modern cultures do, and yet is not characterized by this kind of headlong growth. So that sort of physically it might be more conservative, and biophysically more conservative, but I would have the kind of like metaphysical unmoored quality that, you know, we take modernity to have.
I mean, like if I had to kind of do like a really quick summary to like my friends that I'm gonna meet in a bar after this, I would say, like, well, he kind of posited that the like steady state aesthetics is most comfortable with a growing economy, and it challenges that in its newness and its rejection of capital or its own commodity-ness. So like for example, for China, I don't think that that's the case for their art market at all.
Oh yeah, I mean, well, I'm sure maybe not having expressed myself very clearly. I mean, you know, China's got like the most, you know, dynamic economy in the history of human society, probably, so I would never go looking there for like a steady state aesthetics. Not at all. I guess, you know, the question is, I mean, I don't know if this is a helpful analogy or not, but, you know, all of us at a certain point like cease to physically grow, and yet hopefully not to change, and we might change quite radically in our kind of metaphysical orientation to things. Or, you know, we might be on a fixed income, that's to say our own income is not growing, but what we do with it changes enormously, and what kind of art we're interested in might change enormously, even if our capacity to buy art or consume art didn't economically change at all. So that's kind of what I imagine a steady state aesthetics being like, being sort of modern in the sense of being kind of metaphysically unmoored, but being post-growth. Yeah.
Thank you for your talk. Thank you for addressing a room of cool kids that's not there. So naturally, I think we're equating social and economic really closely, right? Causally, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But then I wonder how I paused when you talked about political liberalism in respect to the art of whatever works, you can do it all, it's fine. Just because I'm thinking about the economic opportunities foregone for most of us by pursuing the social that is art, right?
Yeah.
Like, how many of us are making regular IRA contributions, right?
Mm-hmm.
We've foregone money to do this.
Yeah.
And so in that respect, I guess I'm thinking about you saying, you know, money is stored social energy, but I wonder how that reconciles with the fact that I think for most of us, money is sort of, it's like foregone social energy. It's what we do if we're not pursuing this.
I think that's a very good point. I mean, that, I think, reveals a failure in the passage of my talk that talks, that refers to all that stuff, to distinguish between the reception of art and the creation of art, because the type of sort of growth liberalism or like eclecticism that I'm talking about seems like it could only be a feature of an audience rather than the producer of art himself or herself, who does forego all sorts of opportunities to do something quite risky.
And also, I would say the people around it as well, though. I think maybe crossing and expanding to the people who live there and talk about it within that sphere, that it maybe isn't just a purely commodity relationship, even under these economic times.
Yeah. I don't want to reduce it to pure commodity terms. I think that, you know, it seems to me that like the commodity character of the work of art has become increasingly dominant, but it's certainly not the whole story.
I'd be curious to hear if you see any difference in art that can be commodified post World War II and art that can't be commodified in the ways that developed, like versus the visual arts versus the performing arts.
I do, although I don't know how to sort of reflect intelligently upon that in a kind of spontaneous way. I do. I mean, I think we see interesting things going on with this, like as we speak, probably in terms of music, which is like much more difficult to directly commodify than it was a few years ago before like kind of quite rapid structural transformations in the recording industry, which on the one hand probably points away from commodification, and on the other hand points towards a sort of total commodification of like one's branding of one's personality. And so that's to say, like, you've got to sell like the merch and like your performances rather than your recordings, because recordings aren't going to do it themselves. And you know, maybe you need to sell like the sort of image that allows sort of subsidiary revenues. I think you've sort of pointed towards maybe a problem, but certainly a complication of any sort of talk like this, which is, you know, having kind of created hopefully maybe some sort of big huge heuristic of like how to think about all sorts of art, like then you have to break it down into how it works for quite different types of art. And somebody more knowledgeable than me about the history of fine arts, visual arts, would point, I'm sure, be able to describe like how certain types of works of art, we can think of Judge just because I mentioned him before, like presumably are much more resistant to sort of personal commodification. That's to say, you don't buy that stuff to put in your house, and yet certain commodification works by way of institutions. You do buy certain things to put them in institutions. Visual or a video art is like this, right? I mean, does anybody buy video art to take it home? They do. Surely there are fewer than people. It seems like it's a rather common desire to have something on your wall, and like not such a common desire to have like a couple janky TVs, fizzing on your floor. I guess the way the way in which commodification or the potential for it is going to work for different types of art is, you know, there are big differences there, clearly. Sure.
So, first of all, thank you. And I apologize if I did not absorb this in your hour read. But when I came here tonight, I had an anticipation of what you were going to be talking about. I am somebody who only consumes art, through experientially or actuality through bartering, because I have no money to be buying it. Although I am a maker, and I was thinking that what we're going to talk about had something more to do with steady state aesthetics from the maker's perspective, and what that meant in terms of growth as fetish for an artist. You know, what that novelty and that compulsion versus something different. So, and I was wondering what that would look like.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe you're better, because in a sense you're actually doing this. You're probably a better place to say than I am. But I think that, you know, it's like making art and you know, getting art or something like it in exchange for barter sounds like you know, simple commodity exchange in a sense, or even simpler than commodity exchange. And you know, that's not the sort of thing to do that where you're banking on this being a career. It seems like, I mean, one could maybe hope for that, but not anticipate it, not expect it. So, yeah, I think, I guess I didn't want to be too specific about what steady state aesthetics would be like, simply because I thought, like, you know, a different type of economy would have to come about first, but it may be beginning to come about in a certain way. Not for everybody, but for people who, you know, without, you know, having a lot of money, nevertheless have the time and the capacity to create stuff that they can show to others.
I don't want to eat up too much time, because I know other people want to ask questions, but I guess the stumbling block maybe I had in terms of interpreting your talk and what your talk was maybe aesthetics. Uh-huh. Like, I was thinking of aesthetics from the perspective of the studio and the creation of work. And I think you're talking about aesthetics in terms of art world.
Yeah, that's
currency. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exchange.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, while I hope that I alluded a bit to the production of art, this is a talk like sort of heavily weighted towards the reception.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Let's see, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I saw your talk as, in some ways, a warning about how steady state modes of production are not immune to commodified consumption. And that I think the performance art, I think, is a really interesting example, performance art and video art, in that those modes were trying to work against the modes of consumption that you're critiquing, but they got folded into them anyway, and that via the commodification of experience, right? And so tied to that, I was really interested in the middle of your talk. You basically said that something along the lines of liberals and radicals could both impute their own sense of what art was doing conveniently.
Right.
So they both have a very similar relation to art and in a kind of delusional sense. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about that. Where they each wanted something out of art that it was not going to give them because of that underlying commodification structure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what more to say about that, really, in the sense, and it almost seems to me, I mean, in retrospect, everything seems inevitable, and therefore anybody who hoped for what didn't happen seems delusional, and yet I don't want to sort of, you know, engage in, like, the condescension of posterity and think, you know, those fools who believed in progress, and in particular, sort of, you know, lots of liberal progress has taken place. Yeah, I mean, I guess I think that we should not expect a performance art or any other type of art that it can be sort of so radical that it can, like, resist the structure of commodification by itself. It seems to me that structure is going to change on its own, and that, you know, even someone like Adorno, who's so sort of attuned to this stuff, and at moments seems like he wants just to imagine a type of art that's so unpleasant that it couldn't be commodified, right? It's like as if, you know, Samuel Beckett were to just, like, come out of the closet and sort of, like, stab you in the neck, and you'd be like, no one's gonna buy that, right? And then at moments he's like, oh, well, you know, Kafka has become just furniture of the dorm room and stuff. And you think, yeah, actually nothing sufficiently rebarbative to resist commodification. And if that's the case, it seems like then it was maybe wrong to place one's hopes in something that was sort of, like, adequately uncommodifiable or you know, so uncommodifiable, unpleasant, rebarbative, that it would sort of, you know, resist the whole structure by itself. I mean, it seems like it's more likely that, you know, these changes are going to come from the bottom up rather than from a few rare works of art. Let's see, boy, I'm going to go with you, have a woman. We've got a lot of dudes.
Thanks. Love
the representation. I'm not the representative.
I guess I have a sort of irritatingly optimistic question for you, right? So we're all sort of subject to these economic conditions, and various people have alluded to their relationship to their own production. Okay, so it's two parts. For one thing, I should have done my homework, and I'm not sure what the difference between steady state aesthetics and a socialist aesthetics would be. Because the way that you're describing the opposite of a steady state aesthetics is a capitalist aesthetics that's predicated on a very specific set of class divisions, a consumption at a certain level of wealth. Mm-hmm. So I would like that clarified, but I also wonder is there a sort of role for artists before the steady state revolution then? I mean, is this a matter of perhaps we can't sort of depend on an aesthetic solution to an economic problem, but is there potentially an institutional solution to this, or sort of withdrawal from the market proper that could occur, and a role for creative producers toward this end? We're not going to become economists.
I think so. I mean, I tried to give a couple examples of things that seem to me maybe to anticipate a different type of art making, and I think I'm sure those examples could be multiplied. So that's one vague answer to I guess the second part of your question. As for whether I'm kind of confounding capitalist art with kind of growth art in particular, I think that should a steady state, a sort of eco-socialism ever come about, it would be interesting to contrast this art. Of course, hopefully it would be a different type of culture in lots of other ways, too, to the kind of productivist art of the Soviet experience, whether the kind of earlier modernist stuff or the later socialist realist stuff, which certainly doesn't seem to have like the kind of circular perspective of an ecological point of view. That's to say, it seems like let's just make things and not worry about the cost, not worry about the waste, not worry about ultimate sustainability. You can see anxieties about how that's going to work out in like a novel like The Foundation Pit by Platonov or something. And it seems like in lots of socialist realism, we see what's very much like a growth-oriented aesthetic that is not a capitalist one. I'm never quite sure like to what extent art can kind of prophetically anticipate future social conditions. Like, I think it can, and I kind of go back and forth on like how much it can do so. But I do believe it can do so. And I just kind of go back and forth on the degree to which it can.
So I guess when one of the things you mentioned that I thought was kind of funny was the gross artistic product, mm-hmm. right, which is sort of like your parallel to the gross domestic product. But inside, and I think a lot of your argument sort of comes from relating those two things, right? Mm-hmm. As the GDP grows around the world, and in a theory, like, we have lots more art now too, so there's more of that.
Yeah.
But there's a few kind of problems there. I mean, I think one thing is that in the GDP, it's based on like a fungible asset in the sense that like all these things can be exchanged and they can be reduced to a dollar or something,
yeah.
Which I don't think we can say about art. I think that's one thing. Just because there's more people making paintings, I don't really think it's fair to say there's more art being produced. And I think that a lot of the kind of awkwardness of the argument can be sort of resolved by the suggestion that a lot of what we take for art now just maybe is not art. And that if you reject the notion that the premise that anything can be art and should be, if an artist says it is, if you reject that, then there isn't an infinitely large growing body of art out there.
Yeah.
So that's on one side. On the other side, I think if you look at actual steady state ecosystems, or like theorized ones, right? So you can imagine like some final stage rainforest somewhere.
Yeah.
Those places are marked by really interesting flows of energy, which I think could describe a little bit what I sort of imagine what like an artistic practice might look like in a steady state economy. And they're marked by a few things. One of which is that like they're actually very like resource poor. Like most of the resources are actually occupied by living things and they're being used. And the other thing is that they're marked by increasing diversity. Right, so, and I want to bring that back to the point of, I think you could have increasing artistic production if you see it, artistic production as increasing of diversity within the artistic space.
Yeah.
Right? So like, if I'm going to go look at another like abstract painting or something, maybe I don't even think it's art anymore, and maybe like 100 of them doesn't make 100 more artworks, right?
Right.
But that if you increase the diversity within a limited set of resources, then you're starting to look at something that might be a steady state aesthetics under these terms. However, that doesn't remove novelty, right? That does, it kind of relies on novelty. So you don't lose novelty in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. I mean, I think, I didn't mean to be sort of anti-novelty. The question, I guess, is like, what is the nature of the novelty, not just as sort of a blank value, but like what is the innovation for? I think possibly an analogy to a kind of biological diversity might not be so much like the diversity of works of art, but the complexity that characterized individual works of art. I mean, it would certainly be interesting if like, let's say like popular music at the moment is not characterized by like complexity of strong song structure at all, right? It would certainly be interesting if you lived in a different world where, you know, music that people rather like casually and habitually consumed were more complex or diverse in how it was structured. I think that that's the case. I guess, in my sort of like jive about the artistic product, I guess, insofar as like we should, want to take my remark seriously, which maybe shouldn't do too much, but we could see whether in fact the market capitalization of art was growing over the years recently, and this wouldn't say tell us anything about whether the art was good or not, and I imagine it would have grown pretty considerably, and in fact grown much more than other sectors of the economy in the last 20 years. So there would be kind of like, a gross artistic product in GDP terms, and then something that you and I are probably more interested in, which is like a kind of gross artistic product in terms of what might be embarrassing to call aesthetic value, but that basically we feel is measured in terms of aesthetic value. I wouldn't want to confound those things. I see Gopal has a question.
I did have a question. I think it was partly.
Maybe I'll just do one more. I see you.
I have a question regarding the fact that you are talking about commodities and like looking at art as sort of like a commodity, unless maybe I misunderstood or didn't hear it properly, I don't think that you talked enough about things that condition a production of a commodity according to like a Marxist theory, so basically the labor aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the books that I consider pretty interesting in the past couple of years that we're talking about these things is the Diederichsen's surplus value in art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there was like a number of discussions since then about like how actually we cannot talk about certain things that you mentioned in your talk without reconsidering like what really constitutes and what has changed in terms of the artistic labor that art is particularly pertinent to what you're talking about. So I understand that you purposefully are talking only about commodities and not all the aspects of this equation. But I think that actually there are some aspects of labor that play into this, especially when we're thinking about how the production, the art market created new forms of labor or hybrid forms of labor, artistic labor, for example, outsourcing and participation of a lot of people in it. The whole notion of obviously the question of like how singular authorship is being undermined because it already happened in the sciences, like Nobel Prize is now given more and more often to teams of people finally, and acknowledging this, and eventually it will. This is my kind of futuristic way of looking at it, asking questions about the future, that maybe this will also happen in the arts. Maybe this is one of the most conservative things that has still to be pushed in. If I could propose something for this steady state aesthetic, that maybe would be acknowledging that there are actually, the very concept of that singular author that obviously can be attached to the beginning of a capitalist economy from, Renaissance, like when this started to become like more and more fetishized, then maybe there's a stop to this. And maybe that if we can accelerate and think about the evolution of humanity, and for example, if culture and art in the future will be replaced by other evolutionary adaptations, the whole notion of just one single author is a kind of, it's a construct that is very useful instead of a multitude of co-creators and so I'm just curious, what is your
point? Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. What is the relationship between the work of art and the work of art's, economic value, its price, and socially necessary labor time? And I think, I would imagine, in spite of or even, because of exactly the phenomenon you're talking about, where you've got kind of team production on a kind of Renaissance model, taking place with a lot of the art stars of the present day, there's nevertheless an extremely erratic relationship, I would think, though. Somebody should investigate it between the hours that go into a certain amount of art capitalization. I think pretty fascinating to investigate. Somebody ought to look at that. So that it seems like a lot of the capture of surplus value is probably on the basis of a kind of genius or brand premium that comes from being Damien Hirst atop his team, where he maybe doesn't have to do anything anymore. It'd be quite interesting, a society in which the value of art really had much more to do with the amount of socially necessary labor that went into it would be good. Although one wouldn't want to be forced to compensate people for turning out junk. It's an interesting question. I should maybe say too, this isn't totally connected to your question, but I think that the risk of a talk like this is that it seems essentially sort of moralistic rather than analytic. In many ways, and it is actually because I have my tastes, but that ultimately it's kind of human beings create pretty beautiful and interesting things, and they call it art, and they do this in all different sorts of societies, and they will do so if we ever produce eco-socialism, and also I'm sure produce lots of kitsch, I imagine too, I think I don't want really to imply the work of recent decades, even the kind that seems most susceptible to this critique is necessarily bad stuff. I think in the future people might be like, it was so great that Jeff Koons could just do this stuff in a way, just sort of joyous junk that celebrated the culture of its time, and there's this beautiful capitalist innocence about it that we've now lost, and they might be kind of right about that in a certain way, the way that we can look at art of say feudal society, and we think, well, they didn't feel bad about stuff that we feel bad about now, and it's kind of nice that they didn't, and it's very pretty, in sort of the way maybe even And with a bad conscience, I suppose, like people look at, you know, you people like watch a show like Mad Men, they're like, once upon a time people chain smoked, had three martinis at lunch and like sexually harassed people without compunction. And, you know, well, that must have been fun. I suppose, from a kind of like analytic point of view, I don't know that we can sort of create a hierarchy of this stuff. And so I guess like, I think, I don't want to say it, but fear that I've implied that sort of, the late capital start is bad, and the kind of steady state stuff is going to be great. I just think it'll be different if it ever comes about. I think that's about it. Thanks for coming and for your questions.